welcome to Observations, wherever you may be. It's Kirk and I, Craig, here with you today. We're going to return on Observations today to the analysis of the history of English Bible translations, just Bible translations in general, because the more one knows, the better they are able to discern whether or not they can trust the text that they call Scripture. That's what we're going to do for this hour. This evening, we're going to return to Yeshayah 5. There were five refrains in Yahweh's song, a love song, in Yeshayah 5. And we covered the first of those five stanzas a week ago. We will move to the second this week. Looking forward to doing that because the prophecy most certainly seems to speak directly about what we're doing.
True.
Here we are. What I want to do is backtrack just a little bit so we have our bearings. We had investigated the impetus for this investigation and study was the presentation of Nephilim in the Bereshith Genesis story. Which provides the reason for the flood. Most people haven't got a clue as to why the flood occurred. You know, they say, well, you know, God grieved that he created a man. That's why the flood. Well, why did he grieve? He told us specifically why he grieved, that mankind had become overtly religious and extraordinarily violent, that man was using politics and militancy to destroy life.
Right.
And so God said, you know, enough of that. Killing became a game. And so he just said, enough of it. I didn't create life for the life I created to make a game out of death.
No.
And that's the essence for it. And we were looking at Nephilim. And Nephilim, when it says there were Nephilim in the land, and then there would be the likes of them at another time, when that was presented as giants in virtually all English translations, it sent up a red flag. But red flag for lots of reasons. One is Nephilim doesn't mean giant. In fact, there is nothing associated with Nephilim that would even suggest large. If anything, the term speaks of bowing down. Bowing down in religious submission, bowing down in political submission, falling down as a soldier in war.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about large. It's about man becoming extraordinarily small. And so, you know, and all we had to do was look up the definition of Nephal. Nephal, the YM just makes it plural. There's a verb, Nephal, and it speaks of the things we've just shared. And yet, virtually all English translations rendered Nephilim as giants.
Mm-hmm.
And you just say, how did they get into this mess? Why is it that, and this is one of the things that is so, I think, difficult for a lot of people to understand. Just because 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 Bible translations change Nephilim to giants does not make it so. As a matter of fact, if you've got 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 Bible translations that render Nephilim, which means to bow down in submission, to bow down and fall down religiously and militarily as giants, then you have a common denominator that is a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's the situation where they all copied one another's answers, and yet the first one to attempt the translation got it wrong, and all they did thereafter was copy the mistake of their predecessor. Well, that's a serious problem.
You're not kidding. Well, the lexicons, though, will not say giants. A few of them will because they're tied in with the same publishers that are publishing that. But I found it where they didn't even say giants. Some of the translations in the 26 that I looked at are will say Nephilim. But, you know, they don't explain what different. That's just kind of a cop out.
Yeah, but what's so easy to do is simply to look at, to remove the YM, which just makes it plural, and look at the fall.
The verbal.
I mean, it's the next word up in every Hebrew lexicon and dictionary.
Yes.
And there is not anything associated with giant in the fall in any Hebrew lexicon or dictionary, even if it was published by a Bible translator.
Right, correct.
Or a Bible publisher.
Yes.
And so it's so easy to resolve, and yet there isn't a single translator that made an attempt to resolve it. And so what we attempted to do is to find out how we got into this sorry state of affairs. And what we found with the Nephilim is that the mistake first appeared in the Septuagint. Now, we have to be careful when we say Septuagint, because there's this myth that is so extraordinarily easy to disprove, but it is universally believed that the Septuagint is called 70, the Septuagint, because of the fact that Ptolemy, in ruling out of Egypt, the Greek, descendant of Ptolemy the First, one of the four generals of Alexander, who was given a kingdom carved out of Egypt and Syria and Israel, Yehuda was part of his territory, that he was that someone wrote him a letter suggesting that the Torah was this great piece of literature and it needed to be added to be one of the, whatever it was, 5,000 or 50,000 manuscripts found in the Library of Alexandria. And it is this long letter. And one of the things I've learned, Kirk, is I read things like this. And I do the same thing with trying to distill from the Internet what is credible and what's not. When it's written, there's a certain tone that it starts off with. It's like the remember when a Rape U came out and the University of Virginia was accused of having this fraternity gang rape this girl. And I told you that I read the first paragraph of it, didn't need to read any more of it, just the first paragraph, and I knew that it was not true. There's just a tone that people take. It's an attitude that comes through in the writing when they're lying. Yeah. And, you know, what I found out, of course, at the time I said that, no one else was saying it.
No.
But I knew it for certain to be untrue. I did a number of shows on it. It was certain to be untrue. And, of course, now it's now even the publisher, Rolling Stone, has said, yeah, you're right, it's not true. It wasn't true. None of it's true.
On the 59th page back.
Yeah. Well, none of it's true. Well, a number of the fraternity that was blamed and a number of others have won lawsuits against them. So, I mean, it's common knowledge that it was not true. This letter is one of those things. And, in fact, what's interesting is the person who it is being written to that is responsible for the library at the time of the letter had already been exiled. So, it's just, I mean, it's pathetic. But anyway, their claim was that that six Hebrew scholars from each of the 12 tribes, that would be 70, by the way, not 72, not 70.
Mm-hmm.
My math has not deteriorated that much with lack of use. And that they were put in this room, and then in the, I think, like 5th, 6th, 7th century CE, 700 years later, somebody added to the letter and the myth and said, oh, and they compared translations after that each of them translated the entirety of the Torah, and they compared their translations, and there was hardly a difference between them.
Yeah, well, ask a cop who's investigating something on six witnesses and see if he can come up with the same answer.
Of course, when you read that, you know, no chance that's true. But the fact is, it's not even part of the original letter.
No.
It was added 700 years later or 800 years later. In matter of fact, even the original myth that you had six from each of the 12 tribes, at the time, there were only two of the tribes that were even accessible. The other 10 tribes existed, but they weren't accessible. They had long since fled the region. They were a very long way, from Egypt. Much less a very long way from Israel, Yehuda. So, it when we talk about the Septuagint, we have to recognize that the oldest fragment dates to the 2nd century BCE, but the oldest fragment is about 10% of one chapter of one book of the Torah. About one-tenth of one chapter of one of the five books. So it represents, what, 1/100 of 1%? And then if you're looking for something that would be, would have at least a third or more of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms as part of the text, to say, okay, well, that represents the Septuagint, the earliest of those is the Codex Vaticanus, mm-hmm. and it dates to the late 4th century CE.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when people
long, now that's a long period of time when you have Marcion in the middle.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous to pretend that the Septuagint is an old document. There are a few things that you can do with the Septuagint. There are places where numbers are presented and the Septuagint numbers are presented in the Masoretic, and the places where you can compare them to see if where they agree, where they disagree, and then ascertain which is more likely to be true. But even with the Masoretic text, while it is almost infinitely, I mean that's an exaggeration, but it is materially more consistent with the oldest manuscripts than is anything we can find like of the Septuagint ilk. The oldest is an 11th century, 11th to 12th century text. It's called the Codex Leningradus, not because it was written in Leningrad. Leningrad didn't even exist at the time. It was called the Codex Leningradus because of the fact that is where it was found, and it is by far the most accurate copy of the Masoretic text, but it was not published. In other words, no one had access to it until the late 19th century. So any translation, for example, the King James. Well, the King James is a, if you want to call it a translation, it's actually not. It's a revision. But, you know, it's we're looking at, it's 1609.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Codex Leningradus was not available. It wouldn't be available for another 200 years. There was no reliable Hebrew text for them to use, but it didn't matter. They weren't translating from the Hebrew. They weren't even translating from the Septuagint. They were translating from the Latin Vulgate. And as a matter of fact, they were actually weren't translating from even the Vulgate. All they were doing was revising the Geneva Bible to remove the comments in the footnotes, yes, to that were negative, detrimental, if you will, to their whole mantra. So that's, I mean, that's just the basis of the problem. So we don't have anything from a non-Hebrew point of view, other than the Dead Sea Scrolls, that date to a period that goes as far back as to 2 to 300 BCE. And with the Greek, to suggest that the Greek is a solution, particularly for the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is a joke because of the date that the oldest even reasonably complete copy of the Septuagint exists. And of course, then you have Origen, and Origen, you know, attempted his Hextapala project, mm-hmm. He realized the Septuagint was so divergent that there were so many variations in it that it was no longer credible. And what he tried to do is look at as many copies as he could find and try to distill a common denominator. I mean, every place where they differed, if two said this and three said the other, then he would go with the three, unless he liked what the two said better. Well, this is the problem, and it didn't just happen in the Greek. Now, it didn't happen much in the Hebrew. The Hebrew is the Hebrew scribes are a different caliber altogether. But the Greek scribes, you know, Greeks were storytellers, and so were the Romans with Latin.
You know, I like to exaggerate.
I had a reason to study Roman historians circa 100 to 400 CE. And what I found is that even the most acclaimed of them were storytellers.
Yeah.
You know, one of the most famous stories is the story of Constantine and his conversion to Christianity, and he saw the sign of a blazing cross superimposed on the sun and heard this voice, under this sign, conquer.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what?
Never happened.
Never happened. It absolutely did not happen. It is a absolute, total, and complete fabrication by a Roman historian that was really not a historian. In fact, you can't even call him a biographer. Today we call them a publicist.
A public relations man, yeah.
Yeah, a publicist. And what happened was that the first accounting of what occurred didn't mention it at all. The second didn't mention it at all. But the third time the accounting was written, now we had this whole experience, but it was presented at a place that the general Constantine was not at that time. And, of course, then there's the issue of that he was supposed to superimpose the Cairo on all of the shields. Because that was the sign that he was going to be victorious and conquer.
Yeah.
No one has ever found one. Moreover,
really
what he was doing was despicable.
Yeah.
It was this, the Constantine's fight was it's a civil war. It's what the Roman emperors did at this time. They, each emperor would try to bribe legionnaires, and they would pit one group of Roman legions against another egocentric man's group of bribed legionnaires, and they would fight to the death. So what he was doing was despicable.
Yeah.
He was killing for his own personal gratification.
Right. The phylum.
Yeah, exactly. He was engaged in the phylum. So what we have here is proof that the Latin Vulgate was part of the reason, because what I had assumed with the phylum was that the mistake probably occurred early in the Septuagint, and that the old Latin copied it because they didn't know Hebrew, and that Jerome, Eusebius, Euronius is the name that we like. Sophomoris is yes. That he, it's Sophronius is his last name. So Eusebius Sophronius. So we just call it shortened to Euronius. That he realized that the old Latin texts were so variant, and recognized that his big concern, of course, was what's now known as the Christian New Testament. He could care less about what went before it. Matter of fact, the Latin Vulgate didn't include the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms for a very long time thereafter. But his problem was that he was looking at Latin translations, and the old Latin translations were so variant, he wrote his pope and said, we don't have a chance of winning any argument, because if we say, well, this is what the text says, all of our opponent has to say, which text are you using? Yeah. I've got one over here that says something entirely different.
Yeah.
But I would ask you this. Did any of Yosha's disciples, or Yosha, did they speak Latin?
Not a one.
Not a one. Did they speak Greek?
Not a one. They might have been able to converse a little bit, but they did not write in Greek, I can assure you.
No, in fact, the only reason we have a book of Mark mm-hmm. is because legend has it that Mark was assigned to Shimon Kefesh, whom we've corrupted to Peter, mm-hmm. and because he needed a translator. He spoke Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of the Yosha nor his disciples ever spoke a word of Greek nor a word of Latin. Not one. So at the very best, the Latin would have been a translation of a translation of a translation.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, well, you know, you're going to get the gist of it. Well, the problem here is that there is, if you were to pick the two cultures and languages most hostile to communicating Hebrew ideas, and I have to say Hebrew ideas, the Hebrew language is specifically created by Yahweh himself to convey to humankind who he is, what he's offering, and what he expects from us in return. It is an extraordinarily unique language.
Right. Yeah.
And so if you look at Greek was all about Gnosticism and the intellect of man. Now, the Gnostics were 100% wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just have this romance in America and in the West with the Greek scholars. But the fact of the matter is, they were wrong about almost everything. And their language was designed to convey the ideas that were embedded in their religion, which was paganism and completely wrong, based on the Babylonian religion, and their scholarly ideas, which were Gnosticism, which were completely wrong. You just can't get there through the Gnostic pagan mindset of the Greek culture or the Greek language. But likewise, the Romans were the ultimate beast. According to Yahweh, they were the most vicious civilization in human history. The worst civilization. And there's only one thing that would be worse than Imperial Rome, which would be the Roman Catholic Church, that would grow out of it and tread upon the whole world.
Right. Because they've fallen in love with Paul.
Right. And so Rome is about government and imposition of God-men. Literally God-men. The emperors were God and man combined. They were wholly dictatorial. It was about you capitulate to the Roman government and send your tribute, send your sons to be in the legions. You totally capitulate. And by the way, even when you capitulate, we're going to harass you. We're going to rape your women. We're going to rob you. We're going to harass you even if you capitulate. And if you don't capitulate, we're going to utterly destroy you. That's Rome.
Yeah.
And Rome just swallowed the Greek mindset and the Greek religion wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
These are the two worst languages to try to convey Hebrew ideas.
Can I give you a good example
sure.
of that?
Uh-huh.
This is English versus Hebrew, but English is a romance language, a language that is also filled with more emotions and all these things versus a concrete language that Hebrew is.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a pretty good study one time on evil and good, and where you can read paragraphs of stuff on what the word evil means, bad, wicked, sinful, low, you know, on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing on good, having excellent qualities, proper this and beneficial, mm-hmm. da 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 da. And we'll all say, yeah, that's good.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
then you go to the most basic of what good is, which is Tob.
Right.
And I could reduce it to one word, but I'll reduce it to two sentences, one word and two and a sentence. Functional.
Mm-hmm.
One simple word that you could use for Tob,
yeah.
and that would be the sentence, of course, the easiest thing to say is fulfilling the action for which a person is or thing is to specifically designed.
Yeah. The word that I would use is a synonym of that in that context, be productive.
Yes.
Or another synonym, beneficial.
Beneficial, yeah.
Beneficial, productive, functional. That Tob means that something does what it promises to do, what it was designed to do, that it will deliver a productive and beneficial result.
Yes, a well-oiled or tuned machine, if you like.
Correct. Yes. But it's not just, you know, the TOBE is not just that the machine delivers the intended product. It's that it delivers a useful and beneficial product.
All right.
So the product is beneficial, it is useful, it is productive. That's TOBE.
Yeah. But all of those things are rather tangible things. Like if you ask me to explain what that is or define that or see if – we used to have a thing in college when they were in a classroom on education. And Dr. Rafferty would say, okay, let's tell me what a good teacher is. And he'd write all these things, this classroom of 200 people, and they're all doing all this. And we have all this. And he says, okay, now how do I judge a teacher based on what you've just given me? And you just can't.
Yeah.
But if you said he shows up work on time, he teaches the text, then you can judge
right.
somebody else.
Is he functional? Is he productive? Does
right.
he deliver the desired result consistently without failure?
So then on evil, it's the same. You've got the reverse coin, but the same thing. You know, as someone who is dysfunctional or impaired or abnormal action other than what they were
right.
intended to be.
Right. Ra, which is bad, is that no matter what you do with it, no matter what you put into it, you're going to get a negative result.
Right.
A counterproductive result. Rather than being productive, it's counterproductive. Rather than functional, it is dysfunctional.
Right.
Rather than beneficial, it is exactly the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
Counterproductive, not productive, not beneficial, harmful. It always will deliver a negative result, no matter what's fed into it.
So the point I drew from all that was, as I said, okay, if people say, okay, well, Yah must want you to be good. Well, it's good in the context that he wants you to be. He wants you to understand who he is, what he's doing, and stay on that path. Shemar
right.
Torah, and that's the only way you can understand who he is and what he wants.
Right.
And by studying his Torah and his mitzvah, what are the terms and conditions of his plan to reunite you, reconcile you, and stay on the path, which is the Moed Mikra. You won't find that in Bibles. It just ain't there.
No.
I mean, the language is wrong. You can't convey those simple. It's so easy to convey those simple things for even people like me. I can grab that. I can grab hold of that and say, okay, I understand who you are and what you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep that in the context, then of course you can read some of this stuff. You can read a Masoretic text, and you don't have to change very much or be aware of very much before you find out. Boy, you can translate almost the entire Torah this way. As long as you keep that in context of that, remember that that's Yahweh's name and such, and these things, that's what it has to be. That's the context of everything he says. He wants it to be and do.
As a matter of fact, what's interesting about the Masoretic text is that if you return, which is extraordinarily easy to do, each Hebrew word to the letters that comprise the word,
right.
And you remove the diacritical marks. The diacritical marks, which they put in for vocalization purposes, to a language that already had five vowels. So who knows why they did it? Well, I know why they did it, because they called their system. They called their system Shoah, which means to corrupt and to pervert. Is the Hebrew word Shoah means to pervert and to corrupt.
I mean,
so they even changed the pronunciation of the word, even though it's spelled Shoah in Hebrew. They called it Shav, but they wanted to corrupt particularly the pronunciation of Yahweh's name. And so they came up with these diacritical marks to do so.
Mm-hmm.
If you remove those marks and you just go back to the original letters and you look up every word in Hebrew that uses those letters, and recognizing that if you find an actionable or verbal root, that it's going to define the concept extraordinarily well and consistently, and you look up every word that combined that has the same letters in it, and you do so diligently, you're thorough about what you do, you're consistent in your approach, it will always deliver a tob result.
Yeah.
You'll figure out exactly what the word means. And when you do that, you're going to in every idea that Yahweh conveys about his nature, his plan, purpose, and what he expects from us in return, on these major issues, since he tells us over and over again in so many different ways who he is, what he's offering, and what we need to do to avail ourselves of it, you can be 99.99% certain that you've got it correct, accurate.
Yeah. That's something I didn't know 10 years ago, but I can absolutely, over the years, it just became clearer and clearer and clearer that you can absolutely know what Yahweh said, and you can absolutely figure it out from what the information that we have nowadays.
Right. Yeah, in fact, you know, if you use the Dead Sea Scrolls to check on the Masoretic text, what you find is that once you remove the diacritical markings, which is extraordinarily easy to do, and just look at the letters, they are extremely similar. And the places where they differ in, on average, one word in 14. And the one word in 14 that they differ is usually extraordinarily small. It would be a different form of a verb. By that, might have a different stem on it. It might be a plural versus a singular. It might have, in fact, the most common is, does the wa exist here or not exist here? In fact, I've gotten to the point now where I don't even translate wa some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, why wouldn't you do that? You know, why is and, in addition, then, and it can, the number of places where, because and means to add.
Mm-hmm.
But what you find is that the wa is used mostly in Hebrew as punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no period in Hebrew. No exclamation point, no question mark. And so it's used as punctuation. It's okay, we've just finished one sentence, we're starting another. And the wa is the means to designate, I'm just starting a new sentence here. And so a lot of the times you don't even need to translate it. But you know, there are, that is the most common difference in the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, I'm translating right now Yeshaya 5,
mm-hmm.
and there are a number of just niggly, just tiny little differences between the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is one of those places I've come to the conclusion that the scribe of the great Isaiah scroll just had a bad day when he was copying Yeshaya 5. You know, most of the places, his rendering of the text makes more sense and is more consistent than the places where they disagree, which are usually pretty small, than the Masoretic. And in this case, almost every place where they disagree, the Masoretic is slightly superior.
Yeah.
You know, the scribe of the Great Ice Cross actually misspells a word. So, you know, but what the Dead Sea Scrolls do, because they're dated to anywhere from the youngest is 70 CE, the oldest is about 250 BCE, is they demonstrate just how remarkably consistent the oldest manuscripts are with the 11th century Codex Leningradus Masoretic text, particularly once you remove the vowel pointing, the diacritical markings. Now, when you do the same study, though, of the Greek, it's horrific. You find exactly the opposite. Now, for example, if you look at the significant manuscripts like the Codex Vaticanus, the Codex Sinaiticus, for example, which are 4th century, late 4th century, early 5th century manuscripts. When you compare them to the Textus Receptus, there are somewhere between 250 and 300,000 known variances.
Now, how could a logical human being, male or female, in today's... I understand where you could say, I don't want any part of y'all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't understand it, but I know there are people that just are not interested. know them. We have family who has family, and they're just not interested. I have people in my family not interested.
Mm-hmm.
But how can you continue to support and be part of, all emotion aside and history aside, how could you stare at what you're doing as a Christian,
right,
reading that stuff and perpetuating that myth and spouting that crap, excuse my language,
right,
and even hear this show today, just for
right,
what you're covering, and or read it in print and go, what am I doing? You'd have to just become agnostic or atheistic or something. I mean,
yeah. And that, by the way, that's the good news. The bad news is if you go posterior to that, because every scholar that has studied the oldest manuscripts comes to the same conclusion that Philip Comfort came to. Philip Comfort has the 69 oldest manuscripts in a book called the 69, you know, oldest manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. What he wrote in his introduction should be startling to a Christian. It should cost them their faith. And what he said is that I've only included manuscripts up to the end of the beginning of the 4th century. Because after the Constantine comes to power, right, after Constantine comes to power, the differences are so overwhelming as to not be worth inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the manuscripts that date to the 2nd and 3rd century, of which there's 69 of them, and the early 4th century, there's 69 of them, they differ even more radically from Sinaiticus and Vaticanus than Sinaiticus and Vaticanus vary from the Textus Receptus.
Yeah.
Now, some people will say, oh, but that's not fair. The modern Bible, English Bible translations all say that they're based on the Nestle Allen 27. So, you know, I had an occasion
mm-hmm.
with when I wrote Questioning Paul to validate whether or not the Nestle Allen 27's claim that it's based upon the oldest available manuscripts was true. Because what I did is I have a copy of P46. P46 is among the oldest manuscripts of the Christian New Testament. It happens to include all of Paul's letters. And it dates to the 2nd century BCE. And so every single place that it differs, Paul's, the Papyrus 46 differs,
mm-hmm.
Guess what? The Nestle Allen 27. There's nothing older than Papyrus 46 on Paul's letters.
No.
There's not a single place, not one, that the Nestle Allen 27 picked up the difference in the oldest manuscript. Not one. Or is it just absolutely lying? And so if you're a Christian, your problem is that your text is so unreliable as to be worthless. Literally worthless. I don't care what scholar that's trying to make a buck off you, or what pastor that's trying to get you to put your tush in their pews and your money in their collection baskets tells you. The facts are available, they're ubiquitous, and they are irrefutable.
Yeah.
The text of the Christian New Testament isn't even remotely reliable. And let's just say for a moment, let's just play a game. Let's just say for a moment that it was reliable.
Okay.
What does Yosha say? And by the way, there is no Jesus, so you've got a real problem in your translation, because the J wasn't invented until the 17th century. In fact, it was the third edition of the King James, not the first, not the second, but the third that Jesus first came to exist. So his actual name was Yosha. It means Yahweh saved. After all, he came in his father's name, and the father is Yahweh. And right, Yosha is the diminished manifestation of the father. Yosha simply means Yahweh saves. It's Yahweh in the process of saving us. His longest speech What did he say about the Torah?
He said it is complete and perfect and reliable.
Yeah, and he said, do not think
that, I've come
that I came to change it or to annul it.
That's right.
Then he said, not a single yod or tittle. The yod is the smallest letter in Hebrew. It's the first letter of his name and of Yahweh's name. And the tittle is the strokes that comprise the Hebrew letter. So not even a single letter, the smallest letter, or the strokes that comprise any of the Hebrew letters of the Torah and prophets will be annulled, changed, or done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist.
I look out to wonder.
So now, if you're a Christian, you are duly and completely screwed.
Yeah.
Because you don't pay attention to anything that is in the Torah, Prophet, and Psalm. You don't know the terms and conditions of the covenant. You don't know there's only one covenant, much less this notion, is there a New Testament? No. You don't attend any one of Yahweh's seven invitations to meet. Why? Because you've got this series of 13 books written by Paul that says you ought to forget all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And yet, Yosha, the guy that you think you're following, the guy that you wrongly believe is the founder of your religion, said, don't think I came to do away with it. I did not.
Embrace it.
I'm not here to change, and you can't change, and no one can change even part of a letter. I mean, it's over. If you're informed and you're rational, you cannot be a Christian. That's just the bottom line here. And the same thing happens to be true of Islam. And I wrote Prophet of Doom to demonstrate that one has to be either ignorant or irrational to be a Muslim. And the same thing is true with Christianity. It is a pile of lies. And the underlying text isn't even remotely accurate, and if it is accurate, it's so contradictory, it proves that it can't be relied upon in both cases. Now, this is where we ended our program a little after this, but I want to go right back to this because this one statement ought to have been enough in and of itself to kill Christianity. There was a Latin scholar. His name was Eusebius Sophronius. Now, the reason that most people don't know that name is because somebody in the 17th century changed his name to Jerome. He wrote a letter in 405 CE. Now, 405 CE, this is 375 years, you know, after Yosha. But, you know, almost four centuries after the fact. He wrote a letter to Pope Damascus. Now, I want to tell you, if you are in any way associated with God, you do not refer to yourself as Damascus. I mean, what did, you know, when Abraham, his first, you know, idea was, you know, I only have one person that could potentially be my heir, and, you know, he's this fella that I've had work for me for years, you know, and he's from Damascus.
Yeah.
And Yahweh says, no! No! Absolutely not! No! And of course, Paul.
And Paul is
Paul is the one that met with Satan outside of Damascus. So no, he shouldn't be Damascus,
right?
Right. By the way, he shouldn't be Pope either, because what did Yosha say? Well, call no man, no, call no, no man brother. Father. What does Pope mean?
Father.
Father. Right. There's only one is the Father, and that is our Father in heaven, Yahweh. So anyway, he wrote in 405 CE to Pope Damascus, and this letter should have obliterated the credibility of Christianity before it was imposed by Rome. And it was, by the way, Christianity was imposed by Rome at this time. This is 400 CE is when Theodosius, imposed Christianity as the official religion of Rome. In fact, the date that and the person who is responsible for the transition from Imperial Rome to the Roman Catholic Church is Emperor Theodosius. And he literally said, we're not going to be Imperial Rome anymore. We are going to be the Roman Catholic Church. And that occurred at this time. 400 CE is when Theodosius, Emperor Theodosius, made that declaration. So this is contemporaneous with that. This is now within 3 years of the imposition of Roman Catholicism upon the what's left of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote, "If we are to pin our faith to the Latin text," now that's a real problem because Yahweh didn't write in Latin. Not a single one of Yahweh's prophets spoke Latin. Yahweh is never, would never speak Latin. Latin is the language of Rome. Yahweh and Daniel, as he's talking about the evolution of the beast, the initial beast, the birthplace of the beast, he says is Babylon. And then from Babylon, the beast is going to morph into Media-Persia. And he says, from Media-Persia, they're going to be destroyed, and the beast is going to morph into Macedonian Greece.
Yeah.
And then he said, that's going to be cut into four distinct kingdoms, which is exactly what happened after Alexander beat Darius. And then he says, that is going to morph into the most vicious beast of all, Imperial Rome, which is precisely what happened. And then he went on to say, but that out of Imperial Rome will come the worst beast of all. Not the most vicious, but the beast that actually treads upon the whole world. This is the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they're writing about. And the language of Imperial Rome is the last thing that one should pin their faith regarding God upon. That's the language of the ultimate beast. Beast means satanic, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to pin our faith on the Latin text, it is for our opponents to tell us which. For there are almost as many forms of text as there are copies. This is the same issue we just went over with the Septuagint. And then with the Christian New Testament, particularly if you compare the 69 oldest codexes,
mm-hmm.
Second and third and early fourth century codexes, with the basis of English translations of the Greek today. More variations than there are words. And so, if you're informed, like an argument to, you can't make an argument to Roman Catholicism today that matters because Roman Catholics won't even consider it. But back in that day, they weren't monolithic. Now, and so he was just saying, listen, if somebody's going to, we're going to marshal an argument based upon the Latin text says, all our opponents have to say is, which text? Because he says there are as many variations as there are copies. If, on the other hand, we are to glean the truth from a comparison of many, which is this amalgamation of, if you have a whole pile of lies and you combine those lies together, that somehow a mountain of lies can be deduced to a hill of truth. There's our irrational thought. So why don't we go back to the original Greek?
A little Machiavellian there. Okay.
But the Greek isn't the original.
Mm-hmm.
What did Yosha and his disciples speak?
They spoke Hebrew.
Hebrew. No, so if you don't go back to the original Hebrew, you aren't going back to the original. So
no.
His statement here is a bold-faced lie. Now, but beyond the fact that the statement is a lie, you have the problem that by 400 CE, the Greek text is in worse shape than the Hebrew text, than the Latin text.
Mm-hmm.
That where he talks about there's more, you know, as many variations of it as there are texts. They all are different. Well, the differences in the Greek's texts are far worse. And the difference is here now, in the old Latin text that he was talking about and how they all differed from one another, and there's all these texts out there and they're all different from one another, the Roman Catholic Church destroyed all of those early Latin texts.
Mm-hmm.
So all you have is the Vulgate.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Jerome's amalgamation of them. That's all you have.
You destroy all the copies, all the evidence. So they
That's correct, which is exactly what happened with the Quran. They just destroyed every copy, and they said, oh, well, the copy we have left, that's the original one. That one's perfect. Well, that's what Jerome did. But guess what it didn't get done? He didn't find, and therefore could not destroy, all the Greek texts. Now, what's interesting is that there aren't, they did a heck of a job to try to destroy them in any place that was close to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
100% of those 69 oldest manuscripts of the Greek, they're found in Egypt.
Yeah.
All the way up and down the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them were found in masonry jars inside of walls of rubble, you know, buildings that have long since fallen. So as they dig out an old town in Egypt, and they examine what was, you know, put inside these walls, what they find is that a significant number of them, there was a text. Now, why was the text hidden in those walls? Because that's right. Yeah, back in the day, a book was the price of a car relative to a person's earnings.
Yeah.
So you aren't going to take buy a book, and bury it in the wall of your home, unless to own it was to get killed for it. And if you look at Roman Catholicism imposed the death penalty on anyone who had a copy of their New Testament in any language other than Latin. And if a private citizen owned a Latin copy, they were killed. And if somebody owned a copy that was actually in one of the languages the people themselves spoke, could understand, you're killed. That's why the Roman Catholic Church tried to exhume Wycliffe's body.
Burn him at the stake.
Yeah, and burn him after he was already dead. And then they went after all of his associates to burn them alive. That's why, when Rome destroyed Jerusalem the second time under Hadrian, any Hebrew text they could find, which would have been the oldest copies of Matthew on what's Matanyah, unfortunately, any copy of a Hebrew text they could find, they couldn't read Hebrew, so they didn't know what it said. They don't know if it was of the Torah, of the prophets, of the Psalms, or of something that Matanyah would have written in the language it was actually spoken. If they found any document written in Hebrew, it was wrapped around someone who could read Hebrew. And then together they were burned alive.
Boy, talk about in the fall.
So what were they so afraid of? What was the Roman Catholic Church so afraid of that even a Greek copy had to be hidden in walls?
Well, it would challenge your evidence.
Yeah, so the Roman Catholic Church can't kill you today for having a copy of the Christian New Testament in a language other than Latin. And so when these things are unearthed, they're published. And when you consider that those publications, Comfort's book is the most comprehensive of them, you find that his solution here of going back to the original Greek, A, Greek wasn't the original language, it was Hebrew, and B, they were in worse shape. And we know that for fact than his categorization of the Latin text.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we go to the original Greek and correct the mistakes introduced by inaccurate translators and the blundering alterations of confident but ignorant critics, and further, all that has been inserted or changed by copyists more asleep than awake. Now what he's talking about is the mindset of a Latin scribe. I found this to be true when I looked at Roman historians. Their accounts of history were all absurdly fabricated. And the way they even wrote, you knew that it was absurdly fabricated. And, of course, their great sport was demeaning Jews. But what he's saying here about the Latin scribes is that they're completely unreliable. They put their own spin on everything, and therefore either they're incompetent or they have an agenda. But either way, we can't rely on the Latin text because they're just horrific. And that mindset was far worse in and Greek. And so whether you're dealing with an old Latin translation of a translation or a Greek translation of a of what was spoken, the texts are all provided by people who either were incompetent in translating the Hebrew or they had an agenda and wrote what they wanted people to read.
Preachers always hire a theologian to write, rewrite. Yeah.
So that letter ought to cause any open-minded, informed, and rational Christian to say, I'm not going to be a Christian anymore. I cannot, in good conscience, rely on the text of the Christian New Testament. It is over. I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to pen my text to something that, that I know for certain is unreliable. And Kirk, you mentioned before we began the show that you had found an old book of yours. You like to crack open old books. And this whole book was a book compiled by a fellow that was just and what he did is he took three of the 4th and 5th century codexes. And he tried to do what Origen did in terms of Hextapolo, saying...
Well, he was actually the discoverer of the Sinaiticus in Catherine, St. Catherine's down in Asia.
Oh, okay.
He found it.
All right, yeah.
So he did that. He also got a copy of the Vaticanus and the Alexandrius, and he compared them to find how close they were and footnoted all the differences, which... as I told you, it's about 414 pages of print, and there's probably 10 to 20 corrections on every page on footnotes.
And by the way, they should have been, these three texts,
they should have been,
extraordinarily similar. Not similar to the oldest manuscripts. The oldest manuscripts were not available to them. They were buried in walls because of the fear of what was going to happen by Roman Catholic Church and the imposition of them. But they were all commissioned by the Roman Catholic Church under Theodosius and those that came after him. They should have been the same. They're not.